Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Pavone Group and Vigor, a branding and marketing agency for restaurant, beverage, and hospitality brands. Learn more at vigorbranding.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
Hello, if you're a restaurant looking to become an international restaurant chain, or if you're an entrepreneur who wants to own a franchise, today's episode is for you. My guest is Dan Rowe. He's the CEO and founder of FranSmart, and he takes emerging restaurant concepts and turns them into national and international franchises. He's been called the chain maker, and we're going to talk to him today about his process. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just jump right in. Let's start with FranSmart. Tell me a little bit about it, how you started, maybe a little bit about your history and where you got your start.
Sure. I started washing dishes and cooking, got into technology. I never went to college, so barely got out of high school. But I was lucky enough when I was like 19, for about 5 years, I got into technology. Worked for a guy that grew software companies, made some money. And what do? Go right back in the restaurant business. I bought a franchise of a bagel bakery, and it was a 6-unit bagel chain in Washington, D.C. I lived in California. The idea originally was to bring the franchise to California because there's no bagel shops near me. And I went into business with a buddy of mine and his wife, and they wanted to move to Denver. So we opened up our first franchise in Denver. I had negotiated a deal. I said, hey, if we're successful with this, I want to also do your franchising. And because I'm proving you outside of DC where all your stores are, we were very successful. And I was 23. I think he was 25 or 26. And we were more successful than most of the stores that they had in DC. So we did their franchise development and we grew them from 6 stores to around 200 in about 4 years. Sold the company. One of my shops in Denver was across from the first Chipotle. We tried to get him to franchise, he wasn't interested. He did just fine without us. But somebody who copied him was Qdoba Mexican. So we approached Qdoba. We got involved with Qdoba when they were only open a couple months, helped him put together the whole franchise program, grew that to think about 100 open and a few hundred in development, sold that to Jack in the Box. And at that point, I had grown 2 companies at a time as individual, like 2 different companies at a time under 2 different companies. And then I said, it was 2000, everything was .com back then. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna start a new company. Instead of growing one brand at a time, I'm going to grow a portfolio at a time. So we started FranSmart.
That's brilliant. Now, you know, in talking with you, I've learned a couple things. Number one, I did too work in the restaurant first. And I believe wholeheartedly that everyone should start out working in a restaurant. You've got to take orders. You've got to get things done. You have to execute. You have to talk to people by and large. You have to get to know how to handle problems. I mean, there's a whole lot of education that happens in a restaurant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's also
humiliating and it's humbling. And
it's very humbling.
It's good to see why you should treat people better.
That's right. That's absolutely right. The other thing I will say is I also did not go to college. I was a creative guy. So I just like thought, well, hell, I'm really smart at doing these big ideas and creating stuff. I don't need to go to school. So I didn't. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of funny because one time my daughter was asked in school, like, hey, do your parents ever have any sayings? You know, like, you know, what are they known for saying? And my daughter raised her hand. So my dad said, see, students run the world. So that was me. I was just like an underachiever, but just I worked really hard. So anyway, with FranSmart, you're essentially, you take this guesswork out of franchising, right? You're connecting entrepreneurs that want to get into the restaurant ownership business with emerging restaurants. And I mean, so you're finding great ideas, or you have these great ideas. You're finding people that are business people and maybe good operators, but also teaching them how to operate. So what at the end of the day, what makes a good franchisee?
A good franchisee wants to follow somebody else's system. A bad franchisee buys a franchise and then tries to do everything different or argues with the company. But yeah, I mean, FranSmart's main business, we're a franchise development company. We have big picture vision. So like with 5 guys, You know, we didn't invent burgers. We just saw a micro niche of, you know, fresh burgers, and nobody really owned that segment. We saw Burger King, Wendy's, McDonald's, but nobody was really doing high quality chef-y food. And so Five Guys was in DC. They were near us. They won these awards all the time for best burgers. They had a really, really good hamburger. It was more expensive than the other guys or whatever, but they had four units. And I just said, you know what? I've already grown, you know, a Mexican chain, a bagel chain all across the country. There's nobody else doing this in any other market around the country. And so our playbook has basically become, We've built restaurants in all the top 150 biggest media markets in North America. So New York's the biggest, something around Savannah, Georgia, or something like that is somewhere around 150. And in every market, we know who the best operators are. We know where the best intersections are, the best projects are, the best architects, contractors, food distributors. And so we've just sort of developed this knack for understanding the best known way to do everything in every one of these markets. And so, yeah, we did it with Five Guys. We, you know, wound up growing those guys. I think we grew them from four locations to about 100 open, a few hundred in development. We sold, there are like 2,000 stores. We did with Halal Guys. So here's another thing. Like my premise was, gosh, there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. And when I go to Chipotle or Starbucks, or I'd ask my wife, like, do you know any Muslim actors or singers or apparel companies or tech companies or car companies or food brands? There's a no, 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 no. I'm like, well, wait a minute. There's the biggest demographic population in the world, and there's no brand. And so, and we were opening American brands over in the Middle East. And so, you know, most of our franchisees are super wealthy. Many of them are royal family. And the first night they gee whiz you with their homes and just the way that they live. The second day they're like, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go get street food. And they would take you to some of this amazing, amazing Middle Eastern street food. And I tell myself, I'm like, somebody's going to figure out how to build a brand out of this. And so we did with the Halal Guys. Halal Guys was a cart in New York City for 25 years. They had three carts in the city, not even a food truck, just a cart. But they made really good kind of chicken or gyro over rice with this white sauce, and people stood in line for it. And I'm like, okay, here we go. So I found that same thing, same playbook, biggest 150 media markets, best franchise operators, you know exactly where to put them. So anyone, I mean, sometimes these locations, anybody could succeed there, but that's part of the hack. That's part of the hack is going into these markets, and we pick great operators. I remember the two corporate stores that we built in New York City, both did like ridiculous volume, like two times what a Five Guys in the same location would do, because we picked the right site. The first franchisee in Chicago opened up to like, I don't know, $80,000 a week or some weird number. The first California store that we opened up clear across the country did over $100,000 its first week in sales. Wow. So you take a good concept, you package it right, and then you just have to build the right teams that can handle the volume, pick the right locations. But that's our playbook. We just keep doing it over and over.
It's awesome. And so like, I have to ask, like, so the Halal Guys, I mean, I've eaten it. I mean, I know the carts. I know the whole deal. Did you just like walk up there one day and say, hey guys, I'd like to talk to you about an idea I have?
So they didn't even have a website. They didn't have a website. They didn't have a social media page. They had a fan page. So a fan had created what I thought was the website. It wasn't a website. It was called 53rd and 6 or .com or whatever it was, but it was a fan page. And I basically emailed and I said, hey, I've done this and this and this and this, and I want to do Middle Eastern. And the guy's like, hey, I don't actually own it. I'm creating a fan page because I love these guys. I'm like, can you introduce me to them? And they introduced me to them. But it was funny. I'll never forget. When I went to go meet them, I'm like, hey, I'm the guy that did Five Guys in Qdoba. And they're like, what's that? Like, they don't know. These were super religious Muslim. They come to America looking for the American dream. I mean, awesome founders, amazing, beautiful people, great people. They came to America, they all had advanced degrees, came here looking for the American dream, and America basically shut the door. And they started off driving cabs, and they just, you know, kind of worked really hard. And then they opened a street cart it was originally a hot dog cart that they converted to halal food, and they would use it as a way to sort of give people jobs, like bring family members and friends over here and give them jobs. And they had a couple of these carts, but it's like in the beginning when I was first trying to tell them, oh, I've got this big vision, I want to go do all this stuff. They're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And, you know, because they just weren't, they didn't realize, they didn't see what I saw. And they were not taken at all with my background. They
well,
could care
yeah, less. They had to start with, they started with probably nothing, right? So to get the cart and be able to get a corner probably was like, they felt like they'd achieved a lot, which they had, but they had no idea what the capacity of, that you could bring them, like in the locations and everything.
And they didn't care. They frankly, they said, wow, we don't want to open. What they didn't want to do was be embarrassed, be ashamed. They were like very prideful of what they do. It's funny, when you talk to the owners, they still talk about, they could talk for 10 minutes just about this plate of food and how to make that plate of food perfect. And it's like, that's why they have those long lines, right? Yeah. So like a guy like me, I'm not the reason that they're successful. They're successful because they care about that plate of food tasting the way it tastes. You know, my job is not to screw it up. But that, it took a year from the time I first met them to the time that they finally said, let's go. And it was mainly me convincing them that I wasn't going to screw it up. Like, this is a way that they're feeding their family. They're very proud of what they built. And even though they didn't have social media or whatever, everybody knew what it was. It was just, there's 8 million carts in the city, and three of them have long, like absurdly long lines. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't want me to screw that up. So,
I mean, for us, I mean, you know, we do marketing and advertising. So we focus on the restaurant segment with Vigor. And like, they took off. Is it because, I kind of think it might be, but because of the long lines in New York, because of the word of mouth, do you think it was just one of those things, once they started getting locations, people just kind of knew of it already because they had been exposed to it from the street? Or is it like a lot of word of mouth? Or how do you think the explosion happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, to take a step back, a million people tried to knock them off. Mm-hmm. None of them have. A million people. When this thing started to fly, everybody was putting the word halal on their cart, in their storefront or whatever. When I started franchising this, there was all these Me Too copycats. None of them are around. And it's because they're not authentic and they didn't do the right thing. But no, it took off. What I did is the way I marketed it to people outside of New York was funny. The first few franchisees knew it from New York. Like when they would come to New York, they would go there. And so like my Chicago franchisee, my Vegas franchise, or my Southern Cal and my Houston franchisees, even my DC franchisee, they every time they went up to New York, they went there. So the minute that they found out we were franchising, they bought it. Everybody else, what would happen is we would just market pictures of the line. So initially it was lines of the cart. And so people would be like, what is Roe babbling on about? And it's like this long line would at least stop them to get them to look, you know, at the next line or at the next page. And then as soon as the first couple stores opened, the Southern California store doing $100,000 its first week, that line looked like, I mean, it was quarter mile long. And so like even the news was taking pictures of it. So all I did is reposted what the news, because, you know, it's also a credibility technique.
Sure.
It's like if I post a long, long line, people like, yeah, if the news posts it, it seems more credible. So yeah, we just, in the beginning, we kind of did that. I didn't want to explain with a lot of words what the concept was or what I thought it could be. I just wanted to show long lines. And then that would get people to come see it, try it, eat it. And then you meet the owners and you just know, like we had almost everybody who came in for Discovery Day wanted a franchise, but they wouldn't approve them. They were very picky about who they let in. I mean, it's funny. We had a guy that came in. The minute that they gave any indication they weren't going to run the place right or hire the right team, out. Like they would even get up and leave the meeting. And then we even had a guy come in, I'll never forget it. He goes, does the meat really have to be halal? Does it have to be halal? Because halal food's more expensive. And I'll never forget it. Like we're all looking at each other like, did he just say that? And he did. And it's like meeting was over. Guy flew clear across the country for the meeting. And within 8 minutes, the meeting was over. And so, yeah, there it was. But it's a funny story. But it's such a great concept. It's just a great concept. You think about 1.5 billion people, no brands. It's really the largest, certainly the largest restaurant chain, Middle Eastern restaurant chain in North America. But now we're open in London. We're open in Korea. We're open, you know, we're we're growing. So my goal with that, and you know, also when I started, I'll never forget when I first started growing the company, we got an interview with one of the big New York papers. And I said, this is going to, and we only had carts. And I said, this is going to be the biggest Middle Eastern brand in the world, the biggest Muslim brand, the biggest halal brand, blah, 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 blah. And the lady was laughing on the phone. And I'm like, what are you laughing about? And she goes, Dan, they have carts. And I'm like, I know, but I see something bigger. Yep. So
that's
I'm not always right, but in Halal Guy's case, I was.
Well, I love your line. I've heard you say it many times. You let people vote with their wallets, right? So yeah, you followed the line. It's brilliant. I mean, and your marketing was smart too. I mean, using the news and all that and showing the lines, I mean, that's the proof. And that's masterful marketing. And so that brings me to sort of another question, because it's really an interesting, I'm really interested in what you do. I mean, you find these great products and these great brands. You look at the lines, you say, okay, there's a white space in the restaurant world for this. This can be the next big thing. But then there's also, you need to know a fair amount about real estate, right? There's certain, you just said, there's some real estate that you could put anything in there. I'm sure that's not true, but I know probably any of your products you could put in there and they'd be successful. But then there's also the franchisees, the people that want to own a restaurant, or maybe master franchise, these folks that have like a, you know, they have a serious office and they own a bunch of different brands in some cases. Talk about like the whole thing coming together, that whole thing coming together.
Wait, which part?
Well, just you have the master franchisees, right? So you got to find them. Then there's then there's the real estate part, right?
Yeah.
And then there's also sort of the restaurant part. How does that all work together?
Oh, so for me, I always start with the end in mind. I see a chain for what it can be 10 years down the road. And that tells me the 150 biggest markets in North America, US and Canada, most of the Canadian markets behave like US. So I always talk about North America, but, and then certain international markets, like we've sold tons and tons and tons of deals internationally. So like, I already know where this is going to go. Mm-hmm. I already know the franchisees in those markets. And so I know which ones are going to like the brand and why and how I have to package, or maybe I have to cook it a little longer before I show it to a certain guy. Like I already kind of know that whenever I take on a brand.
Neat.
The most important thing when I get a new brand, because I'm getting them at a very early stage. There's mm-hmm. still hair on them. They're still rough around the edges. They still don't know what they don't know. Five Guys didn't have POS systems, for example. Like the Halal Guys didn't have, they had carts, right? They didn't have POS. So
they had carts.
So it's like, that's okay. It's like, I know the other stuff, but that, and ironically, like what I know is not as important as the fact that Five Guys had a line out the door or Halal Guys had a line down the block. Like I can figure out how to build a system or manual way faster than I can ever figure out how to organically get a line down the road. Like that's
the magic.
Level. So yeah, that is the magic. But what I do is it's really interesting. Like when I don't leave anything to chance, no matter who I'm selling, no matter what brand, what market, and who the franchisee is, I act like they've never been in this business before, because I want to be relentless about getting the right site. So like here, I'm in Scottsdale, right? In Phoenix, Arizona. There's, for any concept, there's 10 or 15 or 20 potential sites, but there's really only 3 or 4 first sites. Like you have to be very careful when you're building a brand in a brand new market, is like there's something very strategic about using real estate and real estate's role in marketing and real estate's mm-hmm. role in branding. And so you have to be really good of knowing exactly where your bullseyes are and coming up with some logic around what kind of order you should be growing. And so we're that kind of pedantic even about real estate. It's not just about, hey, I need a 1200 foot space, 1500 foot space. It's like, no. There's so much more to it. And then once you have the right spot, you have to make sure that your unit economics hit. So that's the thing, is like, you can't go into a spot and then have cost overruns, or you can't have what, you know, it needs to cost what everyone thought it was going to cost to open. It needs to open above whatever sales everybody was thinking originally. It needs to hit profitability faster, because there's all these weird things in people's minds that, like, even if it's a great site and for some reason it gets off to a slow start, all of a sudden people are like, oops, not going like plan. And psychological, they'll start making dumb decisions. They'll start cutting people, cutting marketing, cutting problems. It's like, wait a minute. So we assume all that stuff's going to happen. So we're relentless about how we pick real estate, how we market, how we build the team. I always say you got to staff for the sales you want, and you have to staff for the company you're trying to build. We never sell mom and pop franchises, onesie twosies. We sell territories. And so whenever we're selling like a Halal Guys, for example, the California franchisee opened with a director of operations from Panera, a director of operations from Chipotle, and I think a director of culinary from one of those two concepts too, plus the manager, plus the owners were there. Well, that's also why that first store in California self-funded seven more. Is because you basically open up with the team's bandwidth could easily handle the kind of sales. I think it was doing over $3 million a year, and so you have to staff for that. If you open up doing, $5 million run rate with $1 million team, your sales go down. They never come back up. Mm-hmm. And so, like all of that little stuff, it's like, Dan, you're just the sales guy. It's like, I sell a lot of franchises, not because I'm good at sales. I sell a lot of franchises because I make the brands sell themselves. Mm-hmm. So all the things we talk about are kind of, how do we get the brands to sell themselves? The best marketing tool any brand would ever have selling a franchise is the existing franchisees. And so you have to make those franchisees so successful, so happy, so referenceable that even when you're not there trying to orchestrate just the right reference, even if they just run into somebody, what they're saying sells your franchise.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's the experience the customers get, the franchisees get, everybody. See, it's got to be, everyone's a customer at that point, right? They're selling the actual brands to new franchisees. So that's a really, really great point. So what is the biggest mistake you see like franchisees making? Like when they're first coming to you?
When a franchisee picking the wrong brand, if they pick the wrong brand, if they don't staff the right way, like everybody, think about why somebody wants a franchise in the first place. The only reason to own a franchise is to get wealthy. Like otherwise, it's not worth the risk. Like you're risking capital, you're risking an SBA loan or a loan, you're risking signing a lease. Now you're on the hook for that lease for years. The liability, the cash outlay, the liabilities and the contingent liabilities, those are real costs. The only reason to do that is because you're trying to get to a completely different level in life. And so now the question is, what's the right vehicle to get there? So what's the thing that's going to make so much profit that I want to keep doing it? And how do I do it? Mm-hmm. And so the mistake a lot of people make is they'll pick the wrong brand. So they want to get to Never Never Land. They just pick on the wrong brand to get there. When they buy a territory, so somebody that wants to own 5 or 10 or 20 units, when they open up their first store and they open up with a skeleton crew, we have so much turnover in the restaurant business. You open up a store with a skeleton crew and you even just have normal attrition, mm-hmm. you're constantly in a hole, right? So you have to staff for the volume you want. You have to staff for the company you're trying to build. That has to include redundancy, has to include turnover. So a franchisee who thinks a franchise only costs $300,000 to open, it's like, yeah, but you need another $100,000 in these extra soft costs to basically get to the point, to get to this point. And so it's people not really thinking that through, or at the first sign of things didn't go like I thought, they start cutting, they abandon the big picture and they go start focusing internally. And what happens is you start managing that business down. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest mistake. And then another big mistake is people just not following the systems. Like I interview for my podcast, all these franchisees of other brands. I'm like, tell me the difference between you and you're one of the most successful franchisees and whatever the brand is I'm interviewing the guy for. Like, what's the difference between you and someone who struggles with the same brand? Almost to a T, they go, we just follow the system. And I said, whenever you buy a struggling franchisee stores, how do you make them successful? Go back and follow the systems. Just execute. Like, people are buying Five Guys because they want that burger, those fries to taste exactly like they think. They don't want chicken sandwich. They're not there to get, salad or whatever. They want that. Like, just go back to making that. That's all you got to do. And it's people overthink it. And it's like, that's all you got to do. If you're buying a Jack in the Box, a McDonald's, if you're buying, a Jiffy Lube, right? It's like, whatever it is, it's like, people are going to that brand because they want that experience. All you have to do is give that to them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we always say, like in marketing, what we do, we always say that the definition of a brand is a promise. And, you know, in the case with the restaurants, I mean, if I go to Five Guys, no matter which one I go to, I want them to basically promise me and give me that same thing. Yeah. I want that same product. I don't want it to vary from place to place. So I think that's amazing. Do you find yourself, because I have to think this is somewhat the case, because you find these, I'll say these raw concepts, these great concepts, whether it's the Halal Guys or Five Guys or probably Qdoba when you start with them. I mean, you've launched them. Are you bringing, you always talk about a playbook. Are you bringing that playbook to them? Are you kind of saying, yeah, this is great. Here's how we operationalize this thing. Do you find yourself really kind of setting up the operations a lot?
Almost always. So not, I mean, not only setting, maybe sometimes it's just tweaking, right? Or giving mm-hmm. them some best known mm-hmm. tool we have. Cause some people may actually have really good systems for their one or two or three stores that the owners are constantly there. And even if they don't have a written system, they kind of all know how each other thinks and, you know, all that stuff. So there's really just technique about the best known way to do everything. Marketing, staffing, operations, time and motion studies, like everything you can think of, like we have a tool in our toolbox for it. Mm-hmm. And those tools keep getting changed. They keep getting retrofitted because think about marketing 20 years ago versus marketing sure. today or the tech stack. Like there wasn't even mm-hmm. a tech stack 20 right. years ago. So it's like you have to keep evolving. But our ecosystem in the restaurant business isn't only every restaurant brand I've ever worked with. I'm on the board of the National Restaurant Association. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a CEO I don't know. There's not mm-hmm. a big franchisee of any brand that I don't know. And then Kitchen Fund. So we have a kitchen mm-hmm. fund. We were early investors in like Sweetgreen and Cava and, you know, all kinds of different brands. So like our ecosystem's pretty good and pretty valuable. Like we have a lot of really successful access in our ecosystem to always getting the best answer. And so if there's something coming up or something one of my brands are dealing with, like I just go find two or three people that I know are just knocking it out of the park. And, you know, we sort of get those answers and then we weave that back into our brand. So it's a little bit of cheating, but yeah, it's something that we're able to do. And I are in YPO together. There's like most of the most successful franchisors and franchisees are in YPO. And if you reach out to, I always say success leaves clues. Like if you're trying to get a better answer, like most people are pretty generous with their time. Yeah. Like as long as you're not overtly competing with them or annoying them, they'll kind of help you figure that out. But back to what the stuff we bring to the table is, I think I liken it to a chain that goes around your neck. Like every link in the chain it takes to open a restaurant and operate a restaurant, every link in a chain it takes to what do I have to buy? When do I have to buy it? What's it supposed to cost? Every link in the chain, we feel like we have the best known chain mm-hmm. with the best known links. Mm-hmm. And so any brand that we take on who's used to only having one or two or five or nine or whatever it is, like we'll just have all these links in the chain where like, you know, like some of the things they may say, no, I've already got that. I don't need that. But most often they want help with that. And then I've never seen a concept that I can't figure out how to drive sales and lower costs. Mm-hmm. Like drive sales. I was on a call earlier today with a brand that we're looking at, but it's like, you know, it's some of the stuff, it's sort of like you in marketing. Like you could conversationally talk about marketing of stuff that's just second nature to you, to someone who's not a marketing expert and they right. think you are, you know, a guru. And it's like, mm-hmm. I'm not really a guru. We just have so many of these conversations and we're constantly trying to figure out who's doing something better than everyone else. So we're mm-hmm. constantly having this conversation about the best known way. So when these conversations come up, we're able to just rattle them all off. And it's not, you know, it's just nature of our business.
Yeah. And just, you know, we got to refine, always refining. So like I'm interested now. So someone called you and I know you probably can't say, which I totally respect, but you're looking at something. I mean, is it somebody that says, hey, I've got two like stores and I really think I have something here that could be the next big thing, the next Five Guys, or is it stuff that like you might've stumbled on something, heard about something? I mean, how do they come to you or how does that work?
Well, those are two different things. The way we get brands, half the time they're coming to us or someone will refer someone or someone says, hey, have you checked this out? The other time we know what we're looking for. Like we know what we're looking for and we go after the best known players in whatever the market is. So I'm on this whole Latin kick that nobody's done anything new in Latin since Chipotle, and they're not even Latin. And so they're as white as I am. And so we're on this whole kick. I met Pitbull, the rapper, and he's like, how come no Mexican chains are owned by Mexicans? And how come no Latins own the big Latino restaurant brands? I'm like, let's fix that, because there's probably because they might have like some of the best tacos or best restaurants that you've ever been are in the hands of authentic Latinos.
Right.
Why haven't they figured out how to build chains? Like, I don't know, maybe it's capital, maybe it's confidence, maybe it's know-how. It's like, well, we have plenty of all of those. So now we're targeting Latinos, like Pitbull and I are targeting Latinos with really good concepts. We're giving them everything that both of us know. Think about his ecosystem. Like, we're giving them everything that we know to make, to drive success around that brand. So we're actually going to, we want to get wealthy helping Latinos get wealthy.
That's right? Fantastic.
So that's like, but that was one of these things where as soon as he and I came up with this, I'm like, okay, now I got to go find a really great brand. And in that case, what I did is I went to US Foods, the biggest supplier in the country, or one of the biggest suppliers in the country, said, here's what Pitbull and I are looking for. Who do you know? And all of a sudden, they're like, this brand in Chicago, we think is the next thing, could be the next Chipotle, blah, 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 blah. Fly out to Chicago. And it's like, you were right, right? So that goes from, you know, somebody at US Foods. We told US Foods, I told 90 people what I'm looking for. US Foods basically, you know, said, we have a lot of Latin brands. Here's one that's a standout. And you think about that too. It's like US Foods has something to gain too, because now they have a client that goes from, I think it was 8 stores when we got there. Now it's 13 with 6 or 8 new territories around the country. Now they're going to have, instead of a 8-unit brand, they're going to wind up having a 500-unit customer, you know, and it was because they basically brought it up to us.
That's awesome. So do you think a Latino brand, do you think that's going to be FranceMart's next big thing in the portfolio? Do you have something else cooking, or what do you think the next big thing is?
We have a few brands that are doing record numbers. Like this Latin brand is called Cilantro. It's growing faster for me so far than Five Guys did. Like our first several months, it's growing faster, and it's growing. Every franchisee is a franchisee of another brand. And so they all have experience. They all know what they're doing. They have capital, but they also have a perspective of why they like this brand better than what they're doing. And so it's interesting. Keep an eye on Cilantro. That's going to be a fun one.
And again, I don't know who does your naming, but I love that. I love the name Cilantro because I think that's so approachable, yet it's intriguing. You know?
But it's like Chipotle, right? So it's like Cilantro. But it's a real authentic story, because I'm like, the world doesn't need another Chipotle, another Mexican created by a white guy. Like they need, it should be like, and so our tagline or our positioning is the next big thing in Mexican is actually really Mexican. Mm-hmm. And so this is a family that kind of, you know, snuck into the country and like so many do, and started off humbly through life in America, you know, like the halal guys. But they, you know, they came across and they literally opened up a restaurant to make a living, to feed people, to make a living. Turned out that what they were serving, and it was Latin for Latinos. So they started off their whole careers making this amazing. So think about how tough that customer is. It's not Latino for gringos. This is Latino for Latinos. And it was a standout brand that was doing crazy numbers. And then all of a sudden they had opened 2 locations. They took over a failed Baja Fresh, and it's doing crazy numbers. They took over a failed Chipotle, right? That's America's darling is Chipotle. Right. Where Chipotle couldn't succeed in this area of Chicago, they're packed. They're busy. Yeah. And so you're like, wait a minute, Latino quality. For Latinos. Yeah. People like it. And I'm like, this thing's going to be a monster. And that's why, like, I think we had 6 or 8 people come look at it. All 6 or 8 of them are franchisees now. So they're that's all awesome. Buying the franchise. But that, and then the other thing I'm excited about, we got approached in the beginning of COVID, if you remember, when COVID first happened, the government was scrambling every day with new rules and regulations, and restaurants had to close or could only open every other seat or had to do dividers, whatever. It was driving the industry crazy. And I had a franchise lawyer that said, hey, I've got this electronics brand. Would you take it on? I'm like, I don't think so. I don't know anything about electronics. Long story short, we took it on. That thing's growing faster than any brand I've ever grown. It's way more successful than any restaurant has ever been. It's called Paymore. Paymore Very Electronics. Cool. It's buy, sell, trade new and used electronics. And the irony is a lot of food guys are building it. And then all of a sudden I run across a facial studio, skincare studio called Glow 30. So it's a small little, and I was approached by her commercial broker, her real estate broker. She goes, "Hey, would you ever do like a facial place?" I'm like, "I don't know. I've never even had a facial." And I talked to the lady and she said, "Hey, I want to be the Orange Theory of skincare." I'm like, I don't know what that means. And I've never been to Orange Theory and I've never had a facial, but I saw the lady who was in Bethesda, Maryland. I looked on and through my LinkedIn, I found somebody at Orange Theory in Bethesda. And I said, "Hey, can I Venmo you some money and you go check this place out?" And she said, "Sure." I Venmoed her some cash. She went and checked it out. She looked up my background. She goes, "I don't know what your plan is with this brand, but whatever it is, I'm in."
Yeah.
So she actually left Orange Theory, came to work for me. She's the vice president of for us growing Glow 30. And this is a skincare clinic that's growing faster than, I mean, it's just growing like crazy. So we've gone from being a restaurant franchise development company to a franchise development company. And that's awesome. But we keep looking for food. Like offline, I'll tell you who, but it's, but we're working on a pretty big project right now. Yeah. Like I'm at the end of the day, I like to feed people. There's just something very rewarding about feeding somebody. Someone pays you for the food that you give them and they say, "Thank you." And they come back and they bring friends. Mm-hmm. Like there's just something instantly gratifying about that. So like I'll always be in the restaurant business, but the restaurant industry is getting a little wake up call because it's from a business perspective, it's harder to make money nowadays in restaurants, which is why so many, like at this place, Glow 30, like we just sold all of Arizona to a huge food franchisee. Mm-hmm. Greg Flynn, the biggest franchisee in the world, is just starting to expand with non-food.
The Glow 30 thing, look, I'll be very, very honest. I think it's fantastic because I know that, look, feeding people makes you feel great. If you haven't gotten a facial, I absolutely recommend it. I'm a father of daughters. I'll admit it. I go every 2 months. It is the greatest thing on earth. So the fact that you are on the ground floor of a franchise for this, brilliant. I guarantee it will explode. I mean, in fact, I buy a bunch of the gift cards and I give them out to folks here in the office because I just think it's like a great hour of your life, you know? Yeah. So,
Well, now I can do it. Now, so Glow 30, it's a membership skincare, which is another thing. It's sort of like memberships is the ultimate hack because you make money while you sleep. You basically make money whether people use something or not when you have a membership. Think about fitness studios. Yep. How many times you buy a membership and you don't go and the fitness studio's happy. Yeah. They're happy because you're not there. So they wind up selling 150% of capacity knowing that a third of the morons never show up.
That's right.
So, but that's sort of the membership model. And it's like, man, this thing, you buy a membership but the irony here is people don't not use it. So it's every month the facial changes, right? So like in October, it was like a pumpkin facial. Mm-hmm. July, I think it was like limoncello or whatever. But every month it's a different carefully curated facial and people don't miss it. So it's not like you just get a facial and no big deal, I get one next week. It's people like, no, it's the end of the month. They're going to change this month into next month's. I don't want to miss last month. So the reason I still haven't ever been to Glow is every time I come in for Discovery Day, these guys are booked out 3 weeks in advance. So like if you said you wanted a franchise right now for Glow, the earliest I could book your Discovery Day is like 3 weeks because we want you to get a facial as part of your Discovery Day.
And the facial is the product's holding it up, right?
Yeah. And it's funny, but franchising, like it's weird. We had a record year last year. We had more new franchise sales last year than ever. The first quarter of this year doubled last year. Mm-hmm. So like been doing this for 30 years and that's even food. Like, I mean, our food brands like cilantro, we have the largest, fastest growing Indian brand called Curry Up now. So there's another one. There's 1.5 billion Indians. When you think about how many Indians and Pakistani eat what looks like to you and I Indian food, it's like no one's ever built a brand. And so we, you know, now we have 100 units in development for Curry Up now. We just sold London. So that's now international. So the London franchisee is the Subway franchisee for all of UK. He actually bought all of UK for Curry Up now. So yeah, we're going nuts. We got dessert franchises. We got, you know, we got really good things, but I'm drawn to things that have really good numbers. So like I have a cookie franchise called Smackery's in New York City and there's no real number two to Crumble. and nobody, I mean, Crumble just went like a monster. Yeah. I tried to get Smackery's five years ago before I ever saw Crumble. And I couldn't even get him to call me back. And then finally I knew someone who knew him and we made a deal about a year ago. But there's no number two to Crumble. All the people that are trying to build cookie shops are all doing 600 grand, 700 grand a year. This guy is, he's in 800 square feet. And I think he did $2.3 million wow. last year.
So cookies.
Yeah, cookies.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, ridiculous sales. But he's doing it different. So it's like, well, even in New York, there's a lot of other places that do under $1 million. Why is he doing more than double what everyone else is doing? It's like, that's what I look for. So like, I look for concepts that just do like halal guys. There's a lot of people selling meat over rice with sauce in New York. Only one guy had a line down the block. Yeah. So I got him. It was Smackery's. Right. Only one guy is doing whatever $1,000 a foot in sales. He's $3,000 a foot in sales or whatever he's doing. Even in New York, like by New York standards, that's still two times the sales per foot than any other chain does. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you know, so there's something about that,
something
which
there.
Which makes my life easy because I don't have, you know, like I don't have the guy that's only doing 700 or 800 grand a year in cookies. I have the guy doing 2.3 million.
Yeah.
So makes my life a little bit easier.
Very cool. Let's talk one more thing about the, you're embarking on the podcast journey. You're gonna do smart franchising. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I started a franchise. It's the first question I ask whenever I meet successful franchisees or franchisors. I'm like, what makes you successful? What are you doing? What do you know that I don't? Or what, you know, why are you getting results that other people aren't getting? And so started smart franchising with FranSmart. I just believe success leaves clues and I feel like people are willing to share. And so my first guest on was the biggest franchisee in the world, Greg Flynn. He owns 2,700 something franchises all over the world. He's now going, I mean, I think he's targeting 5,000 franchises. He's going to go to some weird number. And it's like, okay, well, and I'd ask him right on the podcast, what do you do different? Like, why are you getting the results you're getting? Why are you, and without saying it, I'm kind of like, why are you better than everyone else? Or what are you doing that people can learn from? And surprisingly, I mean, he's obviously careful, but he gave some really good tidbits. And then, but like I had franchisees of Five Guys and franchisee, really successful franchisee from Red Robin, right? Mm-hmm. So casual dining is taking a beating right now.
Sure.
Well, here's a guy that's doing double digit sales increases and he's still growing. So I'm like, what the hell are you doing that like Chili's can't figure out and Fridays are closing restaurants and you're building more restaurants. You're doing great. What are you doing? And he'll tell you exactly his secrets of success. A Five Guys franchisee is like, why do you have 80 stores? Why do you, this other guy had 17, another guy had 80. I'm like, what is it you do different than everyone else? They leave that. And one, I had two other guys on that are really, really cool. Well, I had a bunch, but one of them was Don Fox from Firehouse, sold a sandwich shop, right? You think there's not room for another sandwich shop.
Right.
He builds one, he sells it for $1 billion. So it's like, how did you do it? Like, what can my audience learn? Mm-hmm. Or Freddy's, like even after Five Guys, Freddy's, the burger and milk shake company. Same thing, like you get his whole story and you get how he did it. And they tell it in a way that tells you, if you follow what they did, you're going to have the same result. And then one thing right now that I think is mystifying a lot of people is the restaurant tech stack. People don't understand restaurant marketing or the tech stack. Most people don't get it. I had a guy on that I think is the best and most brilliant in the space, and he decoded the whole thing. And not only decoded it, I'm like, give me the app to fix this. Give me the app to fix that. If you were a franchisee, what are the first three things that you'd make sure that you did? And he went into detail about everything. And so it's, you know, stuff that he charges a lot of money as a consultant. He's giving it all away for free. So smart franchising with FranSmart is really just that. It's like, what's the best known way to do everything in a way that people can learn from?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, and I don't know if you found this, but I feel like there's a lot of the same ingredients. I mean, it typically starts with a really good quality product. I think people think a lot of times when there's a franchise or whatever, it's like you figure out ways to skip and to save money. And certainly you have to run the operation, but it's usually a quality product, consistency, great operations. And then I go back to that sort of that brand promise. Like there's a story, there's this great authenticity that kind of exudes and kind of you can carry from place to place. We just had, I just had Betsy Ham from Duck Donuts on. And that's a franchise that kind of grew. I mean, you know, did the world need another donut shop? I mean, you know, Russ DiGilio, the founder, thought so. And a great story. I mean, he was at the Outer Banks. Always thought of like, you know, going and getting fresh donuts at the beach, the Jersey Shore, where we are, lots of places have, you know, fresh, you know, homemade donuts. He couldn't find one. So he thought he should start a donut place at the Outer Banks out in Duck. And that's where it came from. And it was like, I mean, you know, puts it together and it's this great franchise. So I feel like a lot of these guys have just a great story, a passion, and it's an authenticity that, you know, makes it kind of, magnetic. The other people want it and want to grow from it.
Yeah, I agree. But I love Duck Donuts and they're delicious. But you think about it, it's like, well, how did he create that? It's like, because he created it.
Yeah.
Like, how did I do what I did? Because he did it. It's like, that's the biggest thing is people sit on the sidelines like, you got to get going.
Yeah, that's right. You know,
life is short.
That's right. You know, don't be afraid to fail. The whole thing. I tell my daughters all the time. I mean, look, I failed a lot. So the C student guy again, you know, you fail. You just go out there and, you know, hey, look, hopefully you get an A here to bring that average up to a C. But, you know, you're allowed to fail. You go out and try things and pivot and keep going. It's exciting. So you said you start your podcast out with the same question. I end mine with the same question. So I'm gonna ask this. I'm looking forward to your answer. You've created a lot of restaurants. You've built brands all over the world. So your last meal, one final meal, what would you eat, where, and why? And there's a disclosure. You're not going to assault any of your franchisees. You can just pick anything. So,
oh man, probably my last meal is going to be Italian, and it's probably going to be, I don't know. I got to think about this. I wish you sent it ahead of time, but but there's a restaurant in New York City. It's my favorite in the world. And it's because the dad cooks, the mom's the hostess, and the son's the waiter. And it's called Sandro's.
Sandro's. Okay.
And it's the best food I've ever had. It's dinky, teeny tiny, but everything that comes out's unbelievable. It's the opposite of pretentious. It's the, I mean, it's just a neighborhood place that you could walk by 100 times and never know it was there. Every time I go to New York, I block time to go there. That's probably my favorite meal of all places, Sandro's.
I just wrote it down. I'm in New York all the time. So I'm going to try and find, is it in Manhattan?
Yeah. In the Upper East, but it's like, it's awesome. Food's good. Prices are reasonable. You know, and you go there and you feel like they appreciate that you're there, the whole load. But it was definitely my last meal of no matter where would be Italian, like my favorite food. I just can't get enough of that. Yeah. So I love it. But yeah, thanks, man.
Hey, I appreciate it. You know, I could talk to you for hours. It's fascinating. I absolutely enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We'll see you soon.